He led them up the front steps onto the veranda. Daniel picked out President Tafari instantly, even though he had his back turned to them. He was the tallest in a room full of tall Hyter officers. He wore a maroon mess jacket of his own design, although his head was bare. Mr. President, Captain Cajo addressed his back deferentially, and Tafari turned and smiled and displayed the medals on his chest. May I present Dr. Daniel Armstrong and his assistant, Miss Maun? Doctor, Tafari greeted Daniel, I am a great admirer of your work. I could not have chosen anybody more qualified to show my country to the world. Up until now we have been kept in obscurity and medieval isolation by the reactionary old tyrant we overthrew. It is time that Ubomo came into its own. You will help us, Doctor. You will help us bring my beloved country into the 20th century by focusing world attention upon us. I'll do all in my power, Daniel assured him cautiously. Although he had seen photographs of him, Daniel was unprepared for Tafari's eloquence and presence. He was a striking-looking man, exuding power and confidence. He stood a full head taller than Daniel, 6 feet, and had the features of an Egyptian pharaoh carved in amber. His eyes slid past Daniel and settled on Bonnie Mahoon. She stared back at him boldly and wet her bottom lip with the tip of her tongue. You are the photographer. Sir Peter sent me a videotape of Arctic Dream. If you can photograph Ubomo with the same understanding and craft, I will be well pleased, Miss Mahoon. He looked down at her bosom, at the big golden freckles on her upper chest that gave way to a narrow strip of unblemished creamy skin above the top of her green dress. The exposed cleavage between her breasts was deep and tightly compressed. You're very kind, Mr. President, she said, and Tafari laughed softly. Nobody has ever called me that before, he admitted, and then changed the subject. What do you think of my country so far? We only arrived today, Bonnie pointed out, but the lake is lovely, and the people are so tall, the men so handsome. She made it a personal compliment. The Hyter are tall and handsome, Tafari agreed, but the Uhali are small and ugly as monkeys, even their women. The Hyter officers of his staff laughed delightedly, and Bonnie gulped with shock. Where I come from, we don't talk disparagingly of other ethnic groups. It's called racism, and it's unfashionable, she said. He stared at her for a moment. Clearly, he was unaccustomed to being corrected. Then he smiled, a thin, cool little smile. Well, Miss Mahoon, in Africa, we tell the truth. If people are ugly or stupid, we say so. It's called tribalism, and I assure you, it's extremely fashionable. His staff roared with laughter, and Tafari turned back to Daniel. Your assistant is a woman of strong views, Doctor, but I believe you were born in Africa. You have a keener understanding. It shows in your work. You have put your finger on the problems that face this continent, and poverty is the most crippling of those. Africa is poor, Doctor, and Africa is passive and supine. I intend to change that. I intend to endow my country with the spirit and confidence to exploit our natural wealth and to develop the strength and native genius of our people. I want you to record our endeavours. His staff officers, all in the same maroon-coloured mess jackets, applauded this statement. Well, I'll do my best, Daniel promised. I am sure you will, Dr. Armstrong. He was looking at Bonnie again, but he went on speaking to Daniel. The British ambassador is here tonight. I am sure you will want to pay your respects. He summoned Cajo to him. Captain, please take Dr. Armstrong to meet Sir Michael. Bonnie began to follow Daniel, but Tafari stopped her with a touch on the arm. Don't go yet, Miss Mahoon. There are a few things I would like to explain to you, such as the differences between the Uhali and the tall, handsome Hyter whom you so admire. Bonnie turned back to him, thrust out one hip in a provocative stance, and crossed her arms beneath her breasts, pushing them up so that they threatened to pop out of the green dress into his face. You should not judge Africa by the standards of Europe, he told her. We do things differently here. From the corner of her eye, Bonnie saw that Daniel had left the veranda and followed Cajo down onto the floodlit lawn. She leaned close to Tafari, her eyes not much below the level of his. Goody, she said. I'm always looking for new and different ways. Daniel paused at the bottom of the steps and began to grin as he picked out the familiar figure on the crowded lawn. Then he hurried forward and seized his hand. Sir Michael, forsooth! British ambassador, no less, you sly dog. When did all this happen? Michael Hargreave gripped his elbow in a momentary display of un-British and undiplomatic affection. "Didn't you get my letter? All very sudden. Hauled me out of Lusaka before you could say Bob's your uncle. Sword on both shoulders from H.M., arise, Sir Michael, and all that. Shot me down here. But did you get my letter? Did you?" Daniel shook his head. "Congratulations, Sir Michael. Long overdue. You deserve it." Hargreave looked embarrassed and dropped Daniel's hand. "Where's your drink, dear boy? Don't touch the whiskey, locally made. Convinced it's actually bottled crocodile piss. Try the gin." He summoned a waiter. "Can't think why you didn't get my letter. Tried to ring you at the flat in London. No reply." "Where's Wendy?" "Sent her back to Lusaka to pack up. New chap there's agreed to look after your Land Cruiser and gear. Wendy will be here in a couple of weeks. Sent her love, by the way." "Did she know you'd see me here?" Daniel was puzzled. "Tug Harrison gave us the word that you'd be in Yubomo." "You know Harrison? Everybody in Africa knows Tug, finger in most pies. Asked me to keep an eye on you, told me about your assignment here. You're going to film Tafari and make him and Boss look good. That's what he told me, right?"
"Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that, Mike."
"Don't I know it? Complications you haven't dreamed of yet." He drew Daniel away to a deserted corner of the lawn, out of earshot of the other guests. "But first of all, what do you think of Tafari? I wouldn't buy a second-hand country from him without checking the tyres." "Check the engine as well while you're about it," Michael smiled. "The indications are that he's going to make Idi Amin look like Mother Teresa. I saw him giving you 50 lyrical words on his plan for peace and prosperity in the land."
"It's rather more than 50, Daniel corrected him.
"What it actually amounts to is peace for the Haita, prosperity for Ephraim Tafari, and screw the Uhali. My pals at MI6 tell me that he already has his numbered bank accounts in Switzerland and the Channel Islands all set up and nice little sums tucked away in them. American foreign aid."
"Well, that shouldn't surprise you. Everybody's doing it, aren't they?"
"Bar for the course, got to admit it. But he's being rather naughty to the Uhali. Chopped old Victor Romero, who was rather a decent sort, and now he's kicking the manure out of the rest of the Uhali tribe. Some nasty rumours flying about, dark deeds. We don't really approve. Even the PM is a bit browned off with him already. Which reminds me, got some news of a pal of yours."
"A pal of mine?"
"Lucky Dragon. Rings a bell, doesn't it? And you'll never guess who they're sending out to run the operation here." "Ning Cheng Gong," Daniel said quietly.
It had to be. That was the reason he was here in Yubomo. He had sensed it all along. This was where he would meet Cheng again.
"You've been reading my mail," Michael accused. "Ning Cheng Gong is right. He arrives next week. Tafari is giving another party to welcome him. Any excuse for a party with our Ephraim, even you."
He broke off and stared at Daniel.
"Are you all right, dear boy? Taking your anti-malarial, are you? Gone as white as a sheet."
"I'm fine."
But Daniel's voice was hoarse and scratchy. He had a terrible mental image of the bedroom of the cottage at Chiwewe, and of the desecrated bodies of Mavis Inzu and her daughters. It left him feeling sick and shaken. He wanted to think of something else, anything but Ning Cheng Gong.
"Tell me everything about Tafari and Yubomo that I need to know," he demanded of Michael Hargreave.
"Well, a tall order, dear boy. Can only give you the headlines now, but if you drop in at the embassy, I'll give you a full briefing and a peep at some of the files, your eyes only, of course. Even got a couple of bottles of genuine Chivas tucked away."
Daniel shook his head. "We're going up the lakeshore tomorrow to start filming. Tafari has put the entire navy at our disposal. One clapped-out World War II gunboat. But I could drop in at the embassy tomorrow evening."
When it was time to go, Daniel looked around for Bonnie Mahoon, but couldn't find her. He saw Captain Cajo with a group of other officers at the bar and went across to him.
"I'm leaving now, Captain Cajo."
That's all right, Doctor. President Tafari has left already. You are free to go."
You could only tell that Cajo was drunk by his eyes. They had that coffee-coloured haze over the whites. In a white man, they would have been bloodshot.
We will meet you tomorrow morning, Captain. What time?"
6 o'clock at the guest house, Doctor. I will pick you up. We must not be late. The Navy will be waiting for us."
"Have you seen Miss Mahoon?" Daniel asked.
One of the other Haita officers sniggered drunkenly, and Cajo grinned.
No, Doctor. She was here earlier on, but I haven't seen her in the last hour. She must have left.
Yes, come to think of it now, I did see her leave."
He turned away.
and Daniel tried not to scowl and look abandoned as he went out to the Land Rover in the car park. The government guest house was in darkness when he drove up and parked under the veranda. She might be in bed, already asleep with the light out. Despite his altered opinion of her, he felt a stab of disappointment when he switched on the bedroom light and saw that the servants had turned down the beds and rigged the mosquito nets. She had given him the excuse to end it. Why was he not more pleased that it was over? He had drunk just enough of the local gin to have a headache. He picked up Bonnie's bag from the foot of the bed and carried it through to the second bedroom. Then he went into the bathroom and swept her toiletries and cosmetics into her sponge bag and dumped them in the wash basin of the second bathroom down the passage. Then he held his head under the cold tap and took 3 anodyne tablets. He dropped his clothes on the floor and climbed naked under the mosquito net. He woke with headlights sweeping the front of the guest house and shining through the curtains onto the wall above his bed. Tires crunched on the gravel drive. There were voices, and then a car door slammed and the vehicle pulled away. He heard her come up the veranda steps and open the front door. A minute later, the bedroom door opened stealthily and she crept into the room. He switched on the bedside light, and she froze in the middle of the floor. She carried her shoes in one hand and her bag in the other. Her hair was in a wild tangle, sparkling like copper wire in the light, and her lipstick was smeared over her chin. She giggled, and he realized that she was drunk. "Have you any idea of the risk you're taking, you silly bitch?" he asked bitterly. "This is Africa. What you'll get is a 4-letter word, and it's not the one you're thinking of, sweetheart. It's spelt A-I-D-S, AIDS. Tut-tut. Jealous, are we? How do you know what I've been doing, darling? It's no big secret. Everybody at the party knew. You've been doing what any good little whore does." She took a wild, round-arm swing at his head. He ducked under the blow, and the momentum carried her onto the bed. She pulled the mosquito net down on top of herself and fell in a tangle of long legs. The mini-skirt pulled up almost as high as her waist. Her buttocks were bare and white as ostrich eggs. "By the way," he said, "you've left your knickers with Ephraim." She crawled up onto her knees and pulled down the green skirt. "They're in my handbag, ducky." She got unsteadily to her feet. "Where the hell are my things?" "In your room. Your new room across the passage." She flashed at him. "So that's the way you want it. Oh, you didn't really think I'd want to pick up Ephraim's leftovers, did you?" Daniel tried to keep his tone reasonable. "Off you go. There's a good little harlot." She picked up her handbag and shoes and marched to the door. There she turned back to him, swaying with a drunkard's dignity. "It's all true what they say," she told him with vindictive relish. "They are big. Bigger and better than you'll ever be." She slammed the door behind her. Daniel was on his second cup of breakfast tea when Bonnie came out onto the veranda, and without greeting him took her place at the breakfast table opposite him. She wore her usual working uniform of faded blue jeans and denim top, but her eyes were puffy and her expression disgruntled with hangover. The guest house chef was an anachronism from the colonial era, and he served a traditional English breakfast. Neither of them spoke while Bonnie demolished her plateful of eggs and bacon. Then she looked up at him. "So what happens now?" "You make a film," he said, "just the way it's written in your contract." "You still want me around?" "As a cameraman, yes. But from now on, it's a business relationship." "That suits me just fine," she agreed. "It was getting to be a bit of a strain. I'm not good at faking it." Daniel stood up abruptly and went to fetch his gear from the bedroom. He was still too angry to risk getting into an argument with her. Before he was ready, Captain Cajo arrived with 3 soldiers in the back of his Land Rover. They helped carry out the heavy video equipment and load it into the back of the truck. Daniel let Bonnie sit up in the cab beside Captain Cajo while he rode in the back with the heavily armed Haita soldiers. The town of Kahali was very much as he remembered it from his last visit. The streets were wide and dusty, where the potholes had eaten, cancer-like, through the tarmac. The buildings looked like those from the movie set of an old-fashioned western. The main difference that Daniel noticed was the mood of the people. The Uhali women still wore their colourful ankle-length robes and turbans, the Muslim influence apparent in their demeanour, but the expressions on their faces were guarded and neutral. There were few smiles and no laughter in the open-air market where the women squatted in lines with their wares spread out on sheets of cloth in front of them. There were army patrols in the marketplace and on the street corners. The populace averted their eyes as the Land Rover passed. There were very few tourists, and these were dusty, unshaven and rumpled, probably members of an overland safari making their way down the length of the African continent in a huge communal truck. They were haggling for tomatoes and eggs in the market. Daniel grinned. They were paying for a glimpse of purgatory. The overland safari meant amoebic dysentery and punctures, 5,000 miles of potholes and army roadblocks, probably the only package holiday on the globe with no repeat customers. Once was enough to last a lifetime. The gunboat was waiting for them at the wharf. Seamen in navy blue uniforms and bare feet carried the video equipment up the gangplank, and the captain shook hands with Daniel as he came aboard.
"Peace be with you," he greeted him in Swahili. "I have orders to take you where you want to go."
They left the harbour and turned northwards, parallel to the lakeshore. Daniel stood out on the foredeck, and his good spirits returned swiftly. The water was a dark and lovely blue, sparkling in the sunlight. There was a single cloud on the northern horizon, as white as a seagull and not much larger. It was the spray column where the lake spilled over its rocky rim into a deep gorge and became the infant Nile. The ultimate source of the White Nile had been debated for 2,000 years and had still not been entirely agreed upon. Was it those falls where the Victoria Nile out of Lake Victoria joined the Albert Nile in Lake Albert and spilled over at the beginning of the incredible journey down to Cairo in the Mediterranean Sea? Or was it higher still, as Herodotus had written long before the birth of Christ? Did it spring from a bottomless lake lying between the two mountains of Kropfi and Mopfi, and fed by their eternal snows? With the lake spray in his face, Daniel turned to look westward, trying to make out the loom of the romantic mountain peaks in the distance. But today, as on most days, it was a diffuse blue cloud mass blending with the blue of the African sky. Many of the earlier explorers had passed close by the Mountains of the Moon before ever dreaming of their existence. Even Henry Morton Stanley, that ruthless, driven, Americanized Welsh bastard, had lived for months in their shadow before the perpetual clouds had opened and astonished him with a vista of snowy peaks and shining glaciers. It gave Daniel a mystic feeling to sail upon these waters that were the lifeblood pumped from the heart mountains of this savage continent. He turned and glanced up at the open bridge of the gunboat. Bonnie Mahoon was filming. She had the Sony camera balanced on her shoulder and pointed towards the shore. He grimaced with reluctant approval. Whatever their personal problems, she was a true professional. At the end, she'd probably get a good shot of the devil on her way through hell, and the thought made him grin and took the edge off his antagonism towards her. He went back to the chart room below the bridge and spread the survey maps and architect's drawings that Boss had provided for him on the table. The site that had been chosen for the hotel and casino was 7 miles up the coast from the port of Kahale. Daniel saw that it was a natural bay, with an island guarding the entrance. The Ubomo River, pouring down the escarpment of the Rift Valley from the great forests and snowy mountain ranges, debouched into the bay. On the map it looked an ideal site for the holiday complex that Tug Harrison hoped would make Ubomo one of the most desirable holiday destinations for tourists from southern Europe. To Daniel, there seemed to be only one drawback. There was already a large fishing village sited on the bay. He wondered what Tug Harrison and Ning Cheng Gong planned to do about that. European sunbathers would not want to share the beach with native fishermen and their nets, while the odour of sun-dried fish on the racks would not encourage the appetite or add much to the romantic attractions of Fish Eagle Bay Lodge, as the project had already been named.